This call is being recorded.
I want to welcome you to our March conference call. My name is Jim Shapiro, and with me is Stephen Screen. We are co-founders of the Better Fundraising Co., and it's our honor to host this call. As always, we appreciate you. You're a fundraiser. Thank you for the work you do to make the world a better place. We're really honored that you give us just a little bit of your time today. On today's call, we're going to share with you our best teachings on how to ask your donors to give your donations, how to word your asks, and how to do it with vulnerability. Most organizations accidentally sabotage themselves when they ask, and so we're going to show you what to look for in your own appeals, in your e-appeals, why it happens, and what to do about it. And by the way, if you want more helpful content than this call can hold, go to betterfundraising.com and subscribe to our blog. Okay, let's get to it. Stephen, kick us off here on this topic of asking.
Yeah, so asking is one of the biggest ways that your organization makes money, unless you're one of the lucky handful where donations come flooding in without actually talking to your donors. And since it's unlikely that's the case, let's get into it. If you've been on any of our calls before, you know that we tend to start with a couple of big ideas that we think are important and then get into the super tactical stuff, the advice that you can use today. But the first big idea I want to share with you is just to remind you that your donors love to give. They love it. And so if you go into asking for donations, being embarrassed or feeling like you're twisting the arm of your donors, you are not going to have as much success. And so there are two things that you need to be. Number one, you need to be bold. You need to ask boldly for donations today. Not for support, not for partnership. We're going to talk about those things later, but ask boldly. And then number two, my advice is to ask on behalf of your beneficiaries or your cause, not your organization. And let me talk about that for a second, because if you're asking, this is kind of a mind hack that I want you to think about. If you're asking on behalf of your beneficiaries or your cause, instead of asking for yourself or for your organization, you will ask more freely. We see this over and over again in our work with nonprofits around the country. You are just the messenger. You're not asking for money for yourself. You're asking for money for a cause or your beneficiaries. That puts you in a different frame of mind where you are just the messenger and you are able to ask more freely. Jim, you say something powerful about this that'd be good here.
Yeah, the way I should summarize this was when I looked at fundraising was I thought fundraising was sales. You had to sell one person on giving this much and sell another person on giving that much. But then I realized really, fundraising is connecting good people with good work. Or if you're a ministry, you're connecting God's people with God's work.
Yeah, so that's great. That connection thing, I think, is foundational to how a good fundraiser thinks about what they do. They are connecting people with the work that your organization does. A lot of organizations are trying to connect people with their organization, and so we're here to tell you today that that is a good, there's nothing wrong with that, but it is usually not as powerful when asking as connecting your donors to your beneficiaries, because they got in it for the beneficiaries. They got in it for the cause more than they got in it for your organization in the vast majority of cases. There are a couple exceptions there, but so what you want to do is, if you believe that donors love to give, which they do, and you believe that your job as a fundraiser is to connect good people with good work, then you can joyfully ask people to donate. And then the trick here is that when they say no, they're not saying no to you, or they're not saying no to your organization. They're saying no to helping your beneficiaries right now. And I put those two words in there, right now, because they are likely going to say yes later. All they're doing is saying no right now. But because if you know they're good people, and you know they want to help, and you know they love to give, you're going to be more comfortable asking them again later.
Stephen, make sure you say the thing about donors moving fast, because we know they are.
Yeah, happy to do that. So if there are kind of two big ideas that are going to quickly improve how much money any organization can raise, the first one is embracing that your donors love to give, which we just talked about. And the second one is embracing that your donors are moving fast. And by that, I mean they have busy lives and they support several charities. We made a great graphic a few years ago with a quote that says, donors are wonderful, compassionate, busy, self-interested, generous people. All of those things are true. They're giving to lots of different organizations. But you need to remember that they're busy and they're moving fast and they don't have to read your fundraising materials. So here's the sort of startling thing to share that most nonprofits haven't wrapped their minds around, is that most of your donors don't open most of your mail. They don't open your email either. So for instance, in email, your open rates are maybe 30% if you're doing email well. That means that if you send three emails, most donors only remember one of them. So think about that for a second as you think about how often you communicate to your donors. A couple by the ways here. By the way, your board members are going to open everything. Your staff are going to open everything. So they are going to feel like, oh my gosh, you're communicating too much to your donors. But you need to put yourself in a donor's shoes, not in board members or staff's shoes when you look at how much you communicate. The second kind of by the way thing here is, this is why big charities send so many communications. One or more emails a week, at least a letter every month. And most small nonprofits assume that amount of communication would drive donors away, but in fact, it's just the opposite. Those big charities know that donors have full lives. They know that their donors don't open every piece of mail, so they communicate often, and they make sure that donors get their message that they're trying to send. So you just got to wrap your mind around that donors are moving fast, because on average, they're only giving your letters, your emails, your EOPLs a few seconds of attention. Here's what that means for you. If you want to ask effectively, you have to get to the point really fast, because they're not giving you that many seconds of attention. You don't have time to write a really long letter and only ask once at the end and tell them what their gift is going to do. You have to move faster than that. So but as we get tactical here, just remember that your donors love to give, and that you should be asking your donors to give to help your beneficiaries or your cause, not to support your organization, and that your donors are moving fast.
Stephen, that is really good. Thanks for that. It's a good reminder, kind of a big picture umbrella thought there. I just want to jump in just briefly for major donors, and just kind of a segment here for both capital campaigns, major donors. They, too, are moving fast.
That's right.
They might not be receiving all of your communications, although we think they should be receiving most of them. But the idea here is that even our major donors are moving fast, and we need to get their attention by communicating to them often. I see this many times when I'm doing major donor consulting and coaching, when I'm working with organizations that are doing capital campaigns. They want to under-communicate. Yep. They tend to under-communicate. They don't want to bug their donor or upset their donor by over-communicating. And if anyone has followed us long enough, you know that we have three simple words: ask, thank, report. And actually, there's a fourth word: repeat. And so it's not all about asking, but today we are talking about asking. We are talking about the amount of communication you should be sending out and how to ask well. I just want to go there into a sidebar about major donors. They too are busy.
Yep. Well, and I think illustrates why fundraising, just to talk about all that we do, all that everyone on this call does, is hard, because you need to, good fundraising needs to be written both for the person who gives you 5 seconds and for the person who gives you 5 minutes. And so that means that you have to do the design and thinking necessary to make the letter summarizable in two sentences and a headline at the top, and be interesting to read for someone who does read the whole thing. That's a really tough job.
Right.
Now, there's nothing easy about it. If that was easy, right, wouldn't we all be raising twice as much money?
It's true.
That's
true.
Yeah.
Well, Stephen, let's go through some of your simple rules for helping people ask more effectively, because that's really where the rubber meets the road.
Yeah. So I want to start with a simple outline for appeal letters and e-appeals that anyone can follow. And by the way, we say that asking happens most often in appeal letters, e-appeals, and at events. So that's what I want you to have in your head as you're thinking about all this stuff. And so as we get into a simple outline for appeals and e-appeals, and by the way, this works for events too, know that as context that we look at hundreds of appeals and e-appeals around here each year. And early last year, I noticed that the appeals and e-appeals that didn't work that well for organizations all tended to follow a similar outline. And they look more or less like this. Number one, the letter began with a nice greeting from the executive director. Number two, there was a story about a person who had already been helped. And then number three, there was a request for partnership or support the organization somewhere in the last couple of paragraphs. So that's what the majority of these sort of what we might call underperforming appeals looked like. And my guess is that many of you out there are sort of nodding your heads as you look back at your own appeals, as your own e-appeals, that you've seen this before. Maybe you have written some of these where you struggle with, okay, how am I going to write a greeting from my executive director here? And, oh, I need a story of somebody that I've helped, and, oh, at the end, I got to remember to ask someone for help. But the thing I have to share is that this model, this outline, does not work as well as another model. And there is a model that works really well, and it consistently raised more money than what I talked about before. And so just to sort of be a little bit repetitive here, which is really good in your fundraising, the first model that doesn't work as well starts out with, you know, the letters talking about something. Isn't fall nice here this year? Boy, the flowers are blooming as we approach Easter this year, that kind of stuff. Then it gets into a story about a person who has already been helped by the organization. And then at the very end, there's some sort of request for help or partnership or occasionally for a donation, but usually more for support, stuff like that. Here's what worked really well, you guys. Number one, a quick statement that the donor's help was needed. Number two, a situation or problem that the beneficiary or the organization was currently facing. I should say a beneficiary or the organization is currently facing. And then number three, a call to action to the donor to solve that problem with a gift today. That is the outline that works best in appeals and e-appeals. A statement that the donor's help is needed, a situation or problem that the beneficiary or organization is currently facing, and then a call to action to solve the problem with a gift today. And by the way, really smart fundraising writers are putting that call to action both at the beginning and end of their letters because they know that most people don't read the whole thing. So you want to put the call to action in multiple places to increase the chances of a scanner, not a reader, a scanner running into it. So, I mean, that may not be how you tend to handle appeal letters, but I'm sort of here to say today that the evidence is super clear. That second outline works way better than the first line. And we're going to unpack a little bit about why, but anytime you're asking for donations, we recommend following that second outline.
Now, Stephen, when you teach on this, I'm always interested as to why organizations use that first model. And I have a theory, if you don't mind me going there for a second.
Yeah, I have one too.
Okay, good. And I'm sure we'll unpack it. We want to be liked.
Yeah,
we want to be. We don't want to be intruding. We want to create a letter that's kind of warm and things are good. And what we're doing when we do that type of appeal letter is we're not presenting a problem, which is why the second outline works so well.
Yeah, that's right. And the two other big picture ideas I would add to that are, unless you say that you need help today, the donor is unlikely to help you today. Because she's getting appeal letters from several other charities, likely on the same day, who are asking her for help now. There's a whole bunch more good material there, but be urgent. I want to move along. And the other thing to mention there, and this is going to come up a handful of times today, and it's in our free ebook on our website about storytelling for action. But what's the role for the donor if everybody in every communication you send to the donor has already been helped? The donor doesn't have an interesting role to play other than being supporter or partner, and that's just not that compelling to a donor who would prefer to be, sort of in a nutshell, a hero.
Yeah, that's great. Yep. That's well said.
Yeah, so the other kind of big idea here that I want to bring up is the idea of vulnerability. Many of you will have heard of a woman named Brené Brown who did incredible deep and thorough research into vulnerability and shame and guilt. And that doesn't sort of sound that interesting, but it is incredibly applicable to fundraising. And I want to sort of tell you why and share a quote. Her work on vulnerability has led her to believe that people don't create relationships with organizations, especially nonprofit organizations, unless the organization shows some vulnerability. So let me share a quote from her. This is a quote from Brené Brown. Staying vulnerable is a risk we have to take if we want to experience connection. Now, she's talking there about human relationships, and she doesn't know this, but she's talking about fundraising too. Most organizations are never vulnerable. That first outline of the letter is an organization trying to show competence and be nice. We're good at our job. Here's an example of how we're good at our job. We've helped a lot of people. Will you help us more? Help more people. Nobody's at risk. Everything is going fine. There is no interesting role for your donor to play in that approach. The second outline works so much better because it says, hey, there's a problem today. Sharing that problem is true vulnerability and courage. Sharing that problem is saying, we don't have all the answers. We can't help everybody. But donor, there is an incredibly important role for you to play here. Let me show you how your gift can play that role, how through your gift you can play that role. That approach, being vulnerable, asking for help, giving the donor a really powerful role to play in the story, works way better in fundraising than the, we're fine, everybody's fine, would you help us in our good work? That approach just doesn't work as well.
Stephen, I love that you're bringing even more scientifically conducted research into what we're teaching people about fundraising. You know, all this stuff is based on rigorous research, not just what somebody on an organization's board likes or doesn't like or what the ED feels comfortable doing. It's based on research.
Yeah, well, that's what I like about Brené Brown so much is her research is incredibly thorough, and it's a lot like the fundraising research that I have been part of where you're doing deep testing and you're out there talking to individual donors. But the looking at results is just incredibly important. And that results, that deep research is sort of one of the things I'm trying to get across here. There is an incredible body of tested knowledge about how to do fundraising well that most small nonprofits just aren't aware of. They've never had the chance to experience it. So we're trying to share that as far and as wide as possible because, I mean, ultimately, it's just so clear to me that if we share that information, more organizations are going to raise more money. And if more organizations raise more money, our entire world becomes a better place really fast.
I love it. That's what we're going for. Just want to take a moment here. If you have questions during this call, you can email me, jim@betterfundraising.com. That's the way we're going to field your questions, so feel free to email me directly. I'm paying attention to my email right this second. Stephen, let's move into what we might call some rapid-fire tips and tricks that you've been taught, tested, and discovered over the years for how people with us today can raise more money. What can they do? What have you learned?
So we've been talking theory here. We've been talking some big ideas here, and let's now get into the tactics. And I've broken some stuff down into simple categories so people can quickly improve all parts of their asking.
Yeah. And again, I'll mention here that we're going to be sending you a recording of this call, so you don't have to try to write everything Stephen's going to say down, although there's some gold nuggets here. You might want to make a note or two. So maybe make a couple notes. We're going to try and, you know, really get to the bottom of these issues. The recording will be sent to you later this week, so you can listen to it as many times as you'd like.
Yep. And hopefully share it, right? We want as many people as possible to know this stuff. So, here we go. Here's one of my sort of simple rules, but there are four. Let me give you a list of four elements that I make sure are present every single time our clients ask for money. Because we've noticed that when these four elements are present, everything tends to go better and you raise more money. Number one, a human-sized problem that's easy to understand. I'm going to go through all four of these. I'll list them and then I'll unpack it a little bit. But number one, a human-sized problem that's easy to understand. Number two, a solution to that problem that's easy to understand. Number three, the cost of that solution seems like a good deal. And then number four, there's urgency to solving this problem and or negative consequences if the problem is not solved. So unpacking those a little bit, a human-sized problem that's easy to understand. When you present a donor a problem like solving poverty in Africa or ending malaria, and you're asking money for them to end malaria, that is too big a problem for a $25 or $50 or $100 donor to make a meaningful dent in. So for most of your donors, most of the time we recommend presenting smaller problems that donors feel like they can make a meaningful impact. And by the way, it is okay, it's absolutely okay to have the campaign to end malaria or something like that. But when you get down to what you're asking them to do, don't ask someone to do something that they know they can't do. Don't ask a 69-year-old retired female donor, who is the average donor in the United States, by the way, don't ask her to end malaria. She can't. But she can do her part, so you want to break that down into a smaller problem. In this case, it might be provide bed nets for a family. And I'm making this example up off the top of my head, but I think you see there the difference between ending malaria and a smaller problem that she can solve, a human-sized problem of bed nets for one family. So you want to be looking at that, even if you're in a health and human services organization where you do something that's less easy to quantify than bed nets. It could be teaching math to junior high school students. It could be passing certain legislation, all kinds of examples. Get it small, get it human-sized. Number two, there's a solution to that problem that's easy to understand. You don't want to be getting into complex problems of relief and development and social engineering and all kinds of stuff. The solution has to be so simple that 69-year-old donor can understand it really quickly. And that's not because she is simple. It's not because she's not smart. It's because she's moving fast and is looking for something powerful she can do today. So if that powerful thing is easy to understand, you're going to have way more success. So that's number two. Number three is the cost of that solution seems like a good deal. You don't want to ask someone, to go back to our bed nets example, to provide bed nets for $750. Not going to work. Nobody's going to respond. Unless those bed nets also give bionic powers and do all kinds of other stuff. You want the cost to seem like a good deal. Your donors are paying attention to how much impact they get for their gifts. And so we're not suggesting lying or by any means, but your fundraising is going to go well if those bed nets your fundraising is going to go better if those bed nets are $7.50 versus $750. It has to feel like the donor is making a big impact. By the way, this is why matching grants, this is why offers that have multipliers in them work so much better. It's because donors basically see their charitable giving going on sale and they buy two where they might normally buy one. So finally, number four, there's got to be urgency or a reason to act today. I hinted at this earlier, but That's the thing. She's getting asked by a lot of people. She's a busy woman. She's got a busy life. And you need to give her a reason to ask today to respond right now rather than what most nonprofits do, which is sort of say, we hope you'll partner with us at some point. Wouldn't that be nice? That does not work as well when she's trying to decide what to do.
You just kind of beat me to the punch, Stephen. What I was noticing in those four points, there wasn't a lot of partnership language. There wasn't, give us the money so we can go do this amazing thing. We haven't gotten the messaging yet, but it really is about giving the donor a problem to solve that she can solve.
Yep.
Where she is at the center of the equation.
Yeah. So, well, that gets back to what we said at the beginning of the call, which is you want to ask your donor to help your beneficiaries, not to help your organization help your beneficiaries. If you do that, you are creating a better connection between your donor and your beneficiaries. Because remember, they got involved because of your beneficiaries, not because of your organization.
Yep.
So that's why that works so well. And by the way, this is all a whole bunch of trying to explain the data for when you ask like this, more money is raised, more people respond.
Right.
And then what fundraising professionals, the ones that I learned from and the ones that I was involved in testing with, we retest and retest and retest, and we would see these things again and again and again.
More money. More people involved, more donors giving.
Yep.
Usually we get pushback from board members or executive directors or program staff because we're not talking much about the organization here. We're talking
about the
beneficiary and the donor.
That's right. And I was just going to say there's some stuff that has been brought over from marketing that does not apply to fundraising, and a lot of that is what you're hearing from board and executive directors who's like, oh, we got to build our brand, and there's some good stuff about brand building, or, oh, we got to market our organization. There is some good stuff there too, but most of that should not leak into fundraising. Most of the time.
Yep. I have one question that's come through, Stephen. I want to keep us on time, so feel free to punt this if we need to later.
Great.
But this is a common question we receive, and that has to do for giving the donor an example or a very specific thing to fund. Is that an undesignated gift or a designated gift to the organization?
So that's a great question, and I'm going to give you a short answer and an actionable thing to do right now. The short answer is, if you do the things you need to do in your letter and on your reply device or on your giving page, if it's an online gift, the gift can be undesignated. It'll take too long to sort of pull that apart now, but we have a white paper written and designed specifically to help organizations raise undesignated funding. It's on exactly this thing. If you email Jim, it's easy for me to say, email Jim and Jim will send it to you. We're happy to share that information because you want undesignated funding, right? That's the holy grail. You need to be able to pay the lights and buy toner for the copier and all that stuff. But donors respond better to specific examples. So there is a way, ethically, morally, to highlight one example of what a donor's gift will do and tell them that their gift will do a whole lot of other things.
Right, because that's what we want to do, raise those undesignated dollars.
Yep.
Stephen, so we've talked about the offer, but we need to deliver the offer somehow,
yep.
And that's typically done in appeals and e-appeals. So maybe you could unpack some thinking there on how to design these.
Yeah, so we talked about that's perfect. Sorry to talk over you. We talked about the outline that works. We've talked about the four elements that you want present. Let's talk a little bit about designing these things to be most successful, because you are not designing them to look good. Full stop. You're not designing these things to look good. You're designing them to be effective. And what that means is knowing who your audience is, how they interpret information, how people read letters. You got to know all that stuff to be really effective. So here's some. We could go super deep on this, and it's fun to nerd out on heat map patterns and eye tracking studies, but let's just sort of stay top level here. But number one, as you're designing your stuff, your emails, your letters particularly, remember that your donors are moving fast. So make sure what you're asking them to do today is easy to see quickly. Don't hide it in the last paragraph of your letter. Don't hide it in some middle paragraph, two-thirds of the way down the page. This is why organizations use bolding and underline. This is why professional organizations do a lot of stuff in the upper right-hand corner of their letters. That's one of the most looked-at portions of your letter. So they will, you know, put a handwritten note up there that says, your gift will send bed nets today, or matching funds, double your gift. Remember, your donors are scanning more than they're reading, or maybe more accurately, they scan to decide whether they will read or not. So you want to give them, you want to take the most important parts of your message and make sure that the scanners see those parts. So, I wrote a long post on our blog recently about what to underline and what not to underline, and that should be really helpful, actionable information. Go there if you want to know more about that. But so make sure that you're highlighting your main messages in your design. Number two, make the type big enough for an older donor to read easily. That's at least 12-point, ideally 13-point type. You want it to feel a little bigger than normal because your average donor has a little worse eyes than normal. And you want her to be able to read it quickly, even if she doesn't know where her reading glasses are. Number three, make your margins large. You do not want to have what's commonly known as the wall of text, where you've got half-inch margins and small type, and no, the donor just sees a wall of text and flips right over to the next page or blips it over into the recycle bin. You want to make your margins big, at least an inch, ideally maybe an inch and a quarter, and your type large enough so that your lines are not too long, because there is an ideal line length that humans are able to read and comprehend well, and you want to go fit in that line length. I don't want to go too far in the research here, but that's you can Google that and figure out what the ideal line length for a printed letter is. You can do the same for email and web pages, and that's good to know because remember we're designing not to look good, but you want it to look good, right? But that is a secondary design goal. Your primary design goal is that the people you want will get the information you want them to get as fast and as clearly as possible. Okay, finally here, remember that you're in appeal letters, longer letters usually raise more money than shorter letters. We see a lot of organizations cramming a letter onto just one side of one page. You should know that our default setting for appeal letters is one piece of paper with letter on both sides. But a 3- and 4-page letter is a great option. That doesn't mean, by the way, that you just write a long letter and ask only at the end. Those long letters tend to be a little bit repetitive, again, because most people don't read the whole thing. But they do tend to work better. All the tests show that.
Stephen, I'm amazed when we start working with new organizations and we take their old appeal letter style, which is pretty much opposite of this, right?
Yeah.
A lot of copy, very little margins, difficult to read, and just change the design, they raise more money.
Yeah.
And then obviously if we build an offer and we improve the messaging, they'll raise more money. But literally just the design itself, because our donors are busy, they're scanning, they're not reading, right? And they don't have time in most cases to actually read the entire letter. So we need to make it as easy to scan and
right.
comprehend as possible.
That's right. And I want people to sort of take in this list not as a, oh, if I underline the right things, we're going to double our revenue. That's sort of not the lesson to learn here. The lesson to learn here is that there is a whole bunch of stuff that you can do to make your letters more scannable and readable. And all those things are little things you can do to make a donor more likely to give a gift. And organizations that send out hundreds of thousands, millions of letters have been testing these things over years and years and years, and they found out that they tend to do better when they do things like this. So if you want a bold instead of underline, or underline instead of bold, fine. If you want your margin letters to be a little smaller instead of larger, fine. But just look at all these things and know that all of these are tools and tactics to make your letters a little bit more likely to get your donor to respond. And all you're trying to do here is, so I'm going to go philosophical again, but you want to get out of doing what you like and go be sold out for your beneficiaries, so you do the things that donors are most likely to respond to, not what you happen to find most aesthetically pleasing. That's super hard for some people to get. A lot of people don't like being told that, but ultimately we get you and me get paid to help people raise more money, so we want to give you all the tools to raise as much money as possible.
We do. Well, that's a great list, Stephen, and you know, folks on the call here, you're listening to a guy that won an award for the best appeal package in the country a few years back. He knows what he's doing. He's been at this for a couple decades now. He's an expert at both writing and design. So this is Stephen. Thank you for unloading and unpacking those things for us. Just a reminder, you can email me, jim@betterfundraising.com. I see a couple questions that have come through the email. Stephen, I have a question for you. What's the feeling or layout or process for someone who has not yet given my organization a gift? They have yet to become a donor.
Yeah, so commonly called donor acquisition, or asking your not yet donors to give gifts. So just a couple tips here. You want to make your ask as simple as possible. Most organizations, when they're doing donor acquisition, try to sell their whole organization, their mission, their vision, and they spend a lot of time on how good their programs are. And really what you want to do is kind of the opposite. And again, by the way, and I know this from helping to acquire hundreds of thousands of donors over the years and doing lots of tests to see what worked better and what didn't. But in a nutshell, when you're acquiring new donors, you want to follow the same outlines that we have been following through this, the four elements of a successful fundraising ask, and the outline that I mentioned earlier. You want to spend your time in an acquisition piece describing a simple but powerful problem that a beneficiary has, and then show how the donor's gift will solve that problem for the beneficiary. And you want to have a specific cost to solve that problem. And ideally, it's less than $50. Because you want to make it easy. In my big agency days, we called first gifts emotional accidents. It was when we had touched a donor's emotions so much that they felt like, oh, I would love to solve that problem for one person today, or I'd love to take action. This is counter, by the way, to what most organizations do. Most organizations try to appear super competent. We are great at our job. We have all these programs. Look at how holistic our approach is. Let me tell you all these things. Will you partner with us? And that just doesn't work as well. The idea of you being good at your job almost doesn't even come onto the list of things new donors are looking at. They all say they do when you survey them, And some major donors and foundations and so forth, of course, are paying attention to that. But I would say that 98% of your donors, they are, if you emotionally move them, if you present a compelling problem and a compelling solution that's at a good price point, they don't even ask the question whether you're good or not. They assume that you are, and they give you a gift.
Stephen, you mentioned price point a few times, and actually one of the email questions we have come in says this: I know a lot depends on your audience, but in general, is there a price point that works best? I heard you say, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, but for acquisition, $50 or less might be a good acquisition range, but unpack that a little bit for either a first-time, not yet donor, and or an existing donor.
Yeah. Well, first of all, the questioner who sent that in is smart, knowing that it depends on your audience. But where much of my experience is in mass donor acquisition, you want your offer to be less than, you want the price point to be absolutely less than $40, ideally around 20. There are some exceptions to that, but for the most part, that's what you want. And now here's the key. For donors who can, so say it's $20. Say you come down to a small problem that some donor can solve for $20. You want to ask donors who can give more to that, more than that, to solve that same problem for multiple people. Do not make the mistake of saying, "Hey, I need $20 to do thing A, $35 to do thing B, and thing C costs $75. That is a guaranteed way to raise less money and have fewer people respond because you've made it more complex. You've now given them three different things to choose from, and a whole bunch of people are going to abandon. What you want to do is multiple increments of the same thing. $20 to solve a problem for one person, $40 to solve it for two people, $80 to solve it for four.
And the beauty of that, I'll put my major gift hat on, I could, as a major donor, solve it for 100 people or 1,000 people. Mm-hmm. It's still the same principle as there around building the offer. Same for special events. If you can build that one offer, you can ask people to do 5, 10, 100 of whatever we're trying to ask them to do. So that offer really does become the multiplier potentially for your fundraising efforts.
Yeah, and by the way, there's almost no floor for how low that can go. We have one client that makes a ton of that acquires a ton of donors. At their offer is 44 cents. Cost 44 cents to cure one child of these intestinal worms. And they do great. Rescue meals all around the country are doing great at $1.92 for Thanksgiving dinner. Go low and then give donors, and then what you do is, so the $1.92 thing, I did this for a long time. The offer, the thing that we focused on was how important a meal was for $1.92, but we never asked for $1.92. The first amount that we asked for was $19.20. Will you feed 10 people? So that's how you get up to the dollar gift that you want and still have a low offer where it feels like, wow, I can do something that powerful for $1.92. I am way more interested in doing it than I am after hearing about your 19 programs and holistic approach to whole health healing.
Yeah. Well, and I'll just say this, just for you on the call or listening in, we know that developing an offer is not easy work.
Yeah,
and
most right.
You do not have these easy offers. You don't have a 44-cent cure or a meal program. But we do know somewhere within your ecosystem there, you do have an offer. It's wrapped around your budget, wrapped around some of the things you're doing. There is a mathematical equation there that can be tied to a message that will be easy to understand for your donors. It takes time. It takes work. We worked with symphonies. We worked with organizations that manage old historic boats. We worked with nature conservancy organizations. Those are not easy offers, but we've been able to help them.
Yep. This applying this principle is so helpful. And in fact, I wrote a blog on this recently, but the two main ways I see organizations sort of cross the chasm and get to the next level of revenue are, number one, acts of God, which you cannot control. That's like running a housing philanthropy in New Orleans and Katrina comes. Okay, you had nothing to do with that. The second thing is coming up with a powerful offer that a lot of people are attracted to. And that is the thing. That's what took World Vision from a little tiny organization in West Covina, California, in a tiny office to $1.5 billion today, was the offer of child sponsorship. So, getting back into You can tell I love this stuff, right? I'm all over the place. There's lots to talk about. Let me give everybody a tip about the website. More and more gifts are coming in online. It's something like 9%, so 8 or 9% of total giving is coming online, and that's growing by about 12% a year. Your website is becoming more and more important. Here's a simple tip for your website. And you guys, this is so simple, but almost nobody does it. If you want to get more donors and donations from your website, you need to prominently say and show that the donor's gift is needed. Mm-hmm. Most nonprofit websites, if you look at them, you might not even know that they have donors. Like it's all a bunch of happy stories and smiling people, and it looks great, and the problem's being solved, and my gift is not needed today. I'm going to click on over to the New York Times or CNN or wherever I might go. You want your website to show and say that donors' gifts are needed now, and show and say what their gifts will accomplish, following the same principle that we have been going through. Don't make it an online brochure that no one will respond to that happens to have a little tiny donate button in the corner. Have the donor have a really big role in your site.
Yeah, Stephen, you said it. The tiny donate button in the corner. My comment is make it as easy as possible to find that donation button or the place to give a gift. And I've heard you say it before as well. Make the pathway to get to that actual giving page easy, because every time they have to go through a page or through a link, you're losing, I believe it's 50% of the donors that have come to the site. So, yes, the message needs to be clear. There needs to be a problem to solve. And please make that donate button, the donate process, as easy and as kind of stupid simple as possible for your donors once they're at your site.
Yeah, that's right. You want to make your site super clear that donors are important, that the donor's gift is needed, and what their gift is going to do. And the tactical tip there is, you know, most organizations these days have one big banner across the top or two or three sliders that are rotating. Make sure your first or second slider is a clear call to action with a description of what the donor's gift is going to do and a big donate button. A lot of people go to your website. I can guarantee you what I'm about to say. A lot of people go to your website right now with the intention to give a gift, and they get to your site and they either can't figure out how to do it, or it looks like their gift is not needed. And a lot of people abandon because of that. So, we could go in deeper there, but I want to end early enough in time to take some questions. So two more quick tips, but I want to highlight one thing. Do you see the chain of sort of need and the specificity running through everything that we're talking about today, right? When you're asking for donations, saying that you need help and being vulnerable enough to do that, and specificity, getting down in the details of what a donor's gift does. And by the way, what that usually means is being comfortable talking about part of what your organization does and not all of what your organization does. The rescue mission example that we use all the time, you know, most rescue missions have between 10 and 25 different programs, different ways of helping people, but their fundraising focuses on meals because that's how they raise the most money, and they're comfortable doing that. You want to be comfortable doing that too when you're asking, because when you're specific, you're going to raise more money. Okay, I'll stop sermonizing here and do two more quick tips. Number one, the first is for... These are both about segmenting who you're talking to, because your audience does matter. And for your printed mailings, for your appeals, you only want to be sending them to people who have given a gift either in the last 18 or 24 months. You do not want to be regularly sending your appeal letters to a donor who hasn't given in 5 years or to a non-donor. That is almost always a waste of money. There are times to do those things, but regularly is not that time. So most big professional organizations are sending most of their appeals only to donors who have given a gift in the last 12 months, because statistically speaking, the chances of a donor giving you a gift after the 13th month just plummet. So our advice to most small to medium organizations who don't mail their donors often enough is either 18 or 24 months. But don't go deeper than that, except, here's the first exception, for your year-end appeal. You can send that to anyone who's given a gift in the last 36 months.
Yeah, and I just want to pull this apart for a second, Stephen, because this is not only an improvement potentially in fundraising performance of the list, but
everyone listening on the call, you will save money. I mean, if you, let's say you have a database of 4,000 people, but only 500 of them gave you a gift in the last 24 months, you're going to save postage, paper, time, and processing for the 3,500 that just have not given you a gift. So we have seen a reduction in expense and an increase in performance by doing the segmentation work.
Yeah, that's right, and that's just smart fundraising. So our advice for your emails is a little bit different. When you're asking for donations, send them to every email address you have all the time. Do not worry if you get some unsubscribes. That's a good thing. You actually want your list to be, this is a deep topic, but you want your list to kind of be in shape for being asked. You want them to be asked regularly, and some people, when they're on an email list, they're just looky-loos, and they keep getting asked to actually do something. They're going to drop off. That's fine. You actually want some churn in your list. And if you don't have any churn, it means that you're not asking often enough. That would be fun to unpack sometime. But you actually want some people leaving your list. I know that's weird, and it's totally true. But you only want people who are likely to do something on your list. The second thing to say is, if you can, this isn't possible for most people, but you only want to be sending your thanks and your reports, when you're showing donors what happened because they gave a gift, to your donors. So if possible, in your emails, when you're thanking donors or reporting back to donors on what their gifts did, try to only send those to donors. See if you can select those and only send your thanks and reports to donors. The reason for that is when you're thanking non-donors and reporting back to non-donors, you're telling them that they get the emotional hit of goodness and connectedness and dopamine, and they don't have to give a thing. And that's not the message that you want to be sending. This is, you know, there's this whole donor love thing, which is fantastic. There's some tough donor love that needs to happen, and this is one of those things. Reporting back to people the great things that other people's gifts have done does not motivate non-donors to give gifts. Okay, final tip here. This is good. We're going to have good time for questions. This is a bigger picture idea, but what is so helpful for the organizations that we work with is to look at your appeals and e-appeals and your events, sort of lay them all out on the table, the script for the event if you've got one, and ask yourself the question. When you look at all this stuff, who is the hero here? Is the hero the donor, our donor? Or is the hero our organization? This is the subject of our free book, our ebook that you can get on our website if you'd like. But when you ask donors, the big idea is this: when you ask donors to send in gifts, you want to make them feel like the hero, not your organization feel like the hero, right? You've been sort of hearing this again and again through today. You want to show them what they and their gifts will do. Most organizations sort of accidentally, I think, paint themselves as the hero and only ask the donor to be sort of a supporter or a partner. Basically, they're always asked the donors to be Robin to the organization's Batman. That is not as compelling as asking your donor to be the hero instead of the sidekick. And so, and by the way, if your appeals are currently using language that asks your donors to partner with your organization or support our good work, you have downgraded your donors, and you've put your organization in the hero position. And if you put your donor in the hero position, I'm telling you that all of the performance data backs this up. If you put your donor in the hero position, if you can talk about what they and their gifts will do, and this requires vulnerability that we talked about earlier, you are going to raise more money.
Stephen, that's a great set of tips. And for our listeners, if you want to go deeper on this stuff, there's a ton of good posts on our blog recently. There's one on exactly what to underline and what not to underline, one that goes deeper on the idea of vulnerability. There's one of the most important things Stephen ever learned about fundraising, having done this now for 2 decades. That'd be a fun one to read. There's a ton of great stuff there for you to learn from, so please do go to the blog. Okay, I want to bring us back to what Stephen said at the beginning of this call, and then we'll do our best to answer the questions that have come in via email. But let's just pause for a second and be reminded that your donors love to give. You aren't selling them on anything. You're giving them a chance to make the world a better place through your organization. So ask boldly. Don't worry about no's. Don't worry about complaints. And you'll raise more money.
Yep.
Last note before we get into the questions, just want to remind you, we'll be sending you a recording of this call so you can listen to it again and again and share it with others. Please use this call multiple times so you can go deeper in this concept of asking. Stephen, we do have a handful of questions here. Folks have emailed me, jim@betterfundraising.com.
Love it. Keep them coming.
This one comes from Don. He says, my question is how to define the need in a compelling way with a price point that makes sense. So he's talking about building the offer. What's the process for doing this?
Yeah. Well, so there's a super complex process that I'm going to try to simplify here. But basically, you want to go looking for assuming you help people and not a cause here, Don, you want to go looking for the person who most needs help or the type of person who most needs help. And you want to go look for the thing that helps them the most, that's super easy to understand. And it's not a whole program. It's usually just, think of it as, it's got to be something that happens in a moment. So it's not a program or a process. And then you want to figure out about how much it costs to deliver that moment. Not, there's a whole bunch of pricing these things is a bit of a briar patch in that it's tough. But you want to figure out how much it costs to deliver that moment, right? So if it's $1.92 for a meal, but you want to go find someone who clearly needs help and how they are helped and use that as the example of what it is your fundraising does. And can you talk about all the other stuff? Absolutely. But go find those, go looking for those moments. And then the other thing to know, Don, is you want to identify, if you can, three or four of those moments across either the same program or multiple programs. Because not all moments are that knowable or I should say understandable or that compelling or the price point isn't that good, right? Maybe it's a $750 moment. Okay, well, that's going to be a tough sell to someone who's never given you a gift before. So you got to go looking around for other moments or look for parts of that moment. Again, I feel like I keep saying this, but I just wrote a blog post about this where there's an international adoption agency and we isolated the travel fees and government fees to adopt a child from overseas, right? The adoption thing costs several thousand dollars, but we identify that there is this one fee that this one government charges that's like $45. Okay, I can wrap my mind around that, right? And I say that just as an example of you just want to keep on narrowing your scope until you get down to something that's powerful, understandable, and seems like a good deal.
Good answer.
Good answer, Bob.
Yeah. Next question. Rich asks, can you give an example of vulnerability?
Yeah. So, anytime you have a shortfall, you're being vulnerable. Right. This is why shortfall fundraising works so well. We have a $30,000 gap that we need to close before the end of the year. Will you please help us close this gap, donor? That's being vulnerable. Being vulnerable is sharing a story of a person who needs help today. Jim, we do a lot of work with organizations that help homeless moms and kids, and that's talking about a mom who is not yet left the process of leaving homelessness behind forever, but still needs help today and talking about, in this case, how much it costs to keep her overnight in the long-term shelter. That's being vulnerable, saying that there are people who need help today. So anytime you are talking about people who need help today, that's being vulnerable. Or how your organization needs help today, that's being vulnerable too. We can go deeper, but that's a pretty good quick answer.
I'll say this, kind of the counter to that is most board members don't want to be vulnerable.
Yep.
Most program staff don't want to show the vulnerability of the woman who's yet to be brought out of homelessness. So there can be some internal tension about you as a fundraiser wanting and needing to be vulnerable. But as a fundraiser, your job is to connect the donor with the beneficiary and to raise as much money as you can to help them.
Yep, that's right. That is such good coaching because this type of fundraising that we're talking today is often disliked by program people, by board members, by executive directors, because they hold as a value that our organization always needs to appear competent. And that is that's the accidental sabotage of fundraising that we referred to at the beginning of this call, where because we are always appearing competent, there is no powerful role for the donor to play. And we've got to be vulnerable. Go read Brené Brown. You read it and you'll be like, preach it, sister. She's not talking at all about fundraising. And she's to- totally talking about fundraising. We have to be vulnerable. We have to say we need help. Does that say, hey, donor, we're totally mismanaging money and we're incompetent? No. Right? You are paying attention. So you're talking about people who need help today, right? Most nonprofit websites, if you go there, you would think that no one actually needs help.
That's good.
It's an accident, but it's true.
Stephen, last question I have here is from Ben. He says, do major donors who usually have a higher organizational IQ also require a multi-page appeal, or could they be distilled to one page? Let me maybe answer this and then you can put icing on it. Ben, I would say if you are in a relationship with a donor, a major donor, and you've had some face-to-face conversations, some phone conversations, and that individual does have a high organizational IQ, and you know exactly what you're going to ask them for, then yes, you can put it on one page.
Yeah.
But if the mail is going to be your vehicle for communicating and appealing to the donor, and you don't have that interpersonal relationship, phone call, face-to-face, then most likely your appeal package needs to be much longer.
Yep, that's right. And most donors who are getting appeal letters most of the time, they haven't had a significant conversation recently to know enough to know why they're being asked. So the letter is longer. I think we could go in there, but for major donors, they make up such a big percentage of your organizational income from individual donors that you need to take the time to ask that question about every major donor. And if you don't have a personal relationship where you're in touch with them all the time and you know their organizational IQ is high, send them a longer letter. Send them a prospectus. Send them whatever they need to know that. But summarize it. Make it really easy so that in the first two or three sentences or paragraphs of the letter, they know what you're there for, and then unpack it.
Yep. Stephen, that's well said. I have one thought, and then you can close us up. But
yep.
Folks, please do email me, jim@betterfundraising.com, if you have additional questions after this call. I'm happy to answer those. And several of you have emailed me regarding the Storytelling for Action ebook we have available. You don't need to actually request that from me directly. You can go to our website, type in your email address. You'll find a form there, and you'll receive it electronically.
Yep. And so as we leave you, final thought, and that's just thank you. Thank you for being a fundraiser. We think being a fundraiser is the best job in the whole world. And we think being a really good fundraiser, like a capital F fundraiser, is all about connecting donors to beneficiaries and to needs, making the world a better place. And you in that role, doing that, provide an incredibly valuable service to your organization and to your donors. They don't know, everybody. They don't know as well as you do how they don't know how many people are homeless tonight. They don't know how much of the Bible needs to be translated. They don't know so many things that you know. Share those needs with them, connect them, and give them chances to meet those needs. And donors are going to value your organization like crazy. And then here's the best thing. Your career is going to go crazy because you're going to have successfully raised a ton of money. So listen, thank you for all this learning about asking today and for thanking and reporting and so many things. Thanks for being a fundraiser.